Money FM 89.3, the best of Saturday mornings. International News Review.
And we are back with Steve Okun, the International News Review this morning. Steve, the big news this week really was the killing of the 7 World Food Kitchen aid workers in Gaza. Their 3 cars were destroyed in what is now called a mistaken firing by the Israeli Defense Forces. They have fired 2 of their officers and reprimanded several others. This is shaking the foundations of the coalition calling for something different in Gaza.
Yeah, and look, and it all starts with Jose Andreas in World Central Kitchen and the role they play and the role he plays in Washington, D.C. I mean, he is almost considered to be a secular saint in Washington, D.C. I mean, people know him. He has been there for 30 years. So you see him at his restaurants, which are fantastic. But beyond that, you know him as a humanitarian. You see all of the amazing work that he has done in terms of getting people food in these areas. I mean, this is a person who was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize by Speaker Pelosi and a few other Congress people just in January. I mean, and so when this attack was done by the Israeli Defense Forces against a convoy of World Central Kitchen vehicles that were going to feed people and that did everything right and coordinated everything that needed to be coordinated with the IDF, when they were killed, this changed everything. It's a lot of aid workers have been killed in Gaza, and you want to mourn all of them. Yep. But World Central Kitchen is different. It's different for Washington, D.C. It's different for Joe Biden. And this has gotten Israel to act in ways that it has not acted since this war started 6 months ago.
It is shocking. The IDF said those who approved the strikes on these 7 workers were convinced they were targeting Hamas operatives. They called the attack a grave mistake stemming from a serious failure due to mistaken identification. I mean, look, there's 30,000 people that have been killed, men, women, children. You know, they don't know if all of them, how many of them were potential Hamas fighters or not, but certainly the vast majority were not. And this is just really bringing this story to the fore. Joe Biden had very stern words, apparently, in a call with Benjamin Netanyahu earlier this week, saying this. He didn't say it would. He's saying this could impact the arms that the U.S. might send in the future to Israel.
Yeah, look, I mean, again, this is the first time that President Biden has suggested that his support for Israel's war is conditional. Mm. It was always, this is ironclad, you know, the support was ironclad. Israel has a right to defend itself. It has a right to security. It has a right to ensure that it is not going to be attacked again by Hamas, where 1,000 plus Israelis were murdered, and that it had the right to take steps to prevent that from ever happening again. But now the killings of the World Central Kitchen workers has changed that calculus from the United States and said, you have gone too far now. Washington was pretty shocked that how quickly Netanyahu reacted to what Biden said, how that he immediately is opening up, you know, access to Gaza that had been closed through ports and through the, you know, the northern border. Netanyahu came under attack from the right-wing nationalists in his cabinet for having done this. And so this is, you really, when in geopolitics or anything, you say, well, this is going to change everything. This one incident will change everything. This one incident could really completely impact the trajectory of where this war was going and what Israel was doing and what the United States was doing. Yeah. And let's hope that it does change things and that the aid can get to the Palestinians who need to get the aid, that a famine that could potentially come is not going to come. You know, the CEO of World Central Kitchen, not Jose Andreas, but Aaron Gore, the CEO, said that this attack from Israel on World Central Kitchen is not only an attack against them, it's an attack on humanitarian organizations showing up in the most dire of situations where food is being used as a weapon of war and that this is unforgivable.
Yeah, I think they were calling for an unconditional ceasefire, at least a pause immediately, which has not been done, of course. I think something, if I remember the number, 200 or 250 aid workers, volunteers have been killed so far since October.
And what Israel has got to understand, you know, because the initial reaction of Netanyahu was that, well, I'm sorry, but this is, there's a war going on and these types of things happen.
Yeah, the fog of war excuse,
you know,
right?
And that, look, that is not acceptable. And, you know, people say, well, Putin is killing way more people in Ukraine and, you know, so this happens. No, you cannot compare Putin to Israel. You can't compare Russia to Israel. Israel is going to be held to a higher standard than Russia, and it hasn't been acting on it, and it is, I think it will change. Now, what this does in terms of the trajectory of Gaza and the need for a two-state solution and how we're going to get there and eventually get a ceasefire, let alone get to some long-term
that's
solution.
That's so far away.
But we've got to get this first step, and this really could be a turning point, and let's hope it is a turning point, and that people's lives are protected, and that food isn't used is an instrument of war. It shouldn't be.
Let's segue now to Janet Yellen, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, arrived in Guangzhou in China on Thursday. She had meetings yesterday, Friday, and today she is traveling to Beijing. Not sure if she's there yet, but she was scheduled to meet on Friday with the vice premier and the governor of Guangdong province, and now she'll have more meetings in the Chinese capital. Some strong words yesterday as she talked to the American Chamber of Commerce in Guangzhou. And what are you hearing? You've talked to the AmCham folks there. What's your take on this? Is it going to move the needle with the U.S.-China relations?
We've got a floor under U.S.-China relations, which we have not had for a while. So you had, you know, Biden and Xi met in 2022, and then they met in 2023. It had been a year before they had talked. They talked just before Secretary Yellen's visit. So that set up the visit. So you have Secretary Yellen there now, the second time she has been in China, which is very good signs that the top U.S. economic official is meeting with her counterparts. And you have Secretary Blinken is soon to be going next. So we've got a floor. So that's good. But look, in this Biden-Xi call that happened earlier in the week, you know, President Biden said that the U.S. wants to de-risk. It doesn't want to decouple. So we recognize that we have the two economies are connected and we need to continue that. But we are going to take steps to de-risk. Now, Xi Jinping did not like that. And he said what the U.S. considers de-risking in terms of export curbs is suppressing China's trade and technology development and that it's actually creating risks. And so you still have a lot that needs to get worked out in U.S.-China relationship. And Secretary Yellen, who's kind of seen as the last of the establishment approach to China, and that engagement is how we don't have a choice. We have to engage. But she was also there to give a pretty stern warning, which is if China continues to flood markets like electric vehicles and batteries through state subsidies, the U.S. isn't going to allow that. And so there is still quite a bit of tension in that U.S.-China relationship, even though things are getting better. And then she did go to meet with the U.S. business community in Guangzhou and in Beijing, showing how important that business relationship is.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what the actual outcome is. Look, you know, people have got to start talking, have got to talk first before anything can get solved. You know, we've been at a very, very low point with the U.S. China relations recently. And so it does no good for business in this region or anywhere to have this kind of friction happening.
And look, and you know, in that readout from the call between the two presidents, you know, President Biden said, we have to cooperate when it comes to military-to-military communications. We have to cooperate on AI. We have got to figure out what the rules are going to be for AI. Mm. We have to, from a U.S. perspective, we have to cooperate on counter-narcotics. We cannot allow all of the terrible deaths that are taking place in the U.S. through fentanyl. You know, a lot of those chemicals are coming to, you know, for fentanyl are coming from China into Mexico and then up into the U.S. So we have to cooperate in counter-narcotics. We have to cooperate on climate change, of course. We have to have more people-to-people exchanges. So how are we going to cooperate on all of these things when we still have all these areas of concern, like Taiwan, like the South China Sea, like cyber attacks in the U.S. and the U.K. and elsewhere, and like China interfering in the November U.S. presidential election, which all indications are they're interfering to help Donald Trump defeat Joe Biden, which, of course, Joe Biden does not want to see.
All right. You flagged a story to me this week that I think is just absolutely fascinating and must have a lot of folks, not only in the regional embassies here, but also in Washington, very, very concerned. A new study in ASEAN said that over half of Southeast Asian nations prefer to align with China over the U.S. if ASEAN were forced to choose between the two rival superpowers. And this is a survey by a regional think tank, Isaias Yusuf Ishtok Institute here in Singapore. This is pretty shocking, I would say. Were you surprised to see these numbers?
I wasn't surprised, and because you have to get below the headline numbers. So the headline number is that for
it's a heck of a headline.
It's a heck of a headline, right? So the headline number for the first time is in since they've been doing this survey, and I think it's been 5 years now. Mm-hmm. I think is it or the fifth
2020,
survey,
I think.
Right? So it's
yeah.
the fifth survey. It's the first time when they ask the question: do ASEAN people prefer China or the U.S. if forced to choose, right? So they don't want to choose. But yeah. if you're forced to choose, which way are you going to go? And from 2020 through 2023, the U.S. was who they would have chosen, anywhere from 60%. This is the first time it's now basically 50-50. Yeah. It was China 50.5 to the U.S. 49.5. So that number has come down. But when
But the last one was 38%, right? Or 39% preferred China and 61% preferred the U.S. So that's big. I mean, that's a big jump,
right? It's a big jump from last year. Yeah. And so if you look at – then you have to break it down. And when you break it down – In ASEAN almost gets split into two different parts. You have the countries that strongly favor the U.S. Number one by far is the Philippines. Why does the Philippines strongly favor the U.S. now? Because China is totally encroaching on its territorial integrity when it comes to the South China Sea. They're using, you know, water cannons to blast away at Philippine boats and injuring Philippine, you know, of Philippine sailors. So the Philippines strongly favors the U.S., as does not as much Vietnam and Singapore. Mm. On the other hand, Indonesia and Malaysia in particular are to the opposite side favoring China. Mm. And the numbers have shifted so much. And I think you have to say it's because of Israel-Gaza. Hmm. It is that they are so negative towards what the U.S. is doing in supporting Israel that they now say we will choose China over the U.S. So there's a real split in ASEAN. And the question will be, look, if China moderated its behavior in the South China Sea, that may raise China's ratings. If Israel Gaza, if we get to hopefully, we pray, some peaceful solution there, and then you'll see those numbers come back. So I think it's not that surprising in this year to see that 50-50 number. Mm. The question is, will that continue 2 or 3 years down the road?
Interesting. Interesting.
If you look, if you're the U.S., one of the things that you see that you would say you really like is that if you ask the question, who do you trust to uphold the rules-based international system, then the U.S. wins that one outright. So there's a lot to be favored for the U.S. there. Mm. But you also see people being concerned that the U.S. doesn't care about Southeast Asia as much as it used to. Mm. And that in a way, you'd say, well, that's kind of surprising because the U.S. is doing more and more here.
Yeah,
from
and there's
the
been this whole the whole rebalance and the whole and, Indo-Pacific and yada,
economic
yada, yada.
Framework. Right? And that is going down. So the question is, which way are we going? So it's an interesting snapshot. It's an important snapshot, but I wouldn't be overly concerned of it yet. Let's see what happens.
Let's close out the show with something that many of our listeners may not be aware of or follow, and that is women's college basketball in the U.S. this year has wildly changed in terms of people that are interested in watching. Over 12 million people watched a recent game. This is a college women's game. Several key players are really just exploding the scene. Right now, we're in the middle of something called March Madness, which are the college playoff games for both men's and women's teams. We're coming down to what they call the final four teams, so two on two and then one on one for the championship, right, in the U.S. So it's a very interesting time and a very exciting, energized time for college basketball in the U.S. What is happening with women's college basketball, maybe for the novices who might not know the teams and the players, Steve?
Well, think of it this way. There's a women's basketball player in Iowa. Her name is Caitlin Clark. She's basically the Taylor Swift of women's college basketball. Maybe the Taylor Swift of all basketball. She is the greatest scorer in the history of college basketball, men or women. She has scored more points in her college career than anyone. She is, you know, she's like kind of Steph Curry in that she can shoot from almost anywhere on the court. She is a tremendous passer. And so she has just brought so much energy to the game and excitement, and that. And it is crossover. It's not like, you know, men who have girls and say, hey, here's a role model for you, because that quite often will happen in women's sports. But she transcends this, and you get more people watched a final eight game. So not the championship game, not even a final four game, but a final eight game. There were 12.3 million people who watched this Iowa LSU game last week. It's the most watched women's college basketball ever. More people watch that than watch the World Series, which used to be America's pastime. More people watch that than but one of the five games in the NBA Finals, which is on broadcast television as opposed to cable television. It is remarkable what she has done. And so the question is, can she and all the attention that she has brought, and then other players like Angel Reese and others.
Angel Reese of Louisiana State University and also Juju Watkins at USC have been, you know, those three players especially, but there have been others, have really had this spotlight on them.
And right now, as we're speaking, which is why all my friends in the U.S. aren't listening to us right now, Iowa is playing Connecticut in the Final Four to go to the championship game. Now, and the hope is that neither Iowa nor Connecticut flush the mouse and that we get a really competitive game tonight, because that will crush the 12.3 million people. And if Iowa were to get to the finals against South Carolina, shout out to my UVA classmate Dawn Staley, who is the coach of South Carolina, it will set more records.
So the interesting thing about this is Caitlin is a senior. She can opt to play one more year in college, or she can go pro to the WNBA, the women's basketball thing. And those, as one of the other players too, I believe, is Angel?
Angel Reese. They've both decided.
Angel is already committed. She's going,
and
right?
So did Caitlin Clark. Okay. They both have committed to going to the...
So the question is now, is the fact that they are going to be in the WNBA finally going to raise the salaries and the things of the WNBA players, because they're literally pennies on the dollar compared to the first draft picks for the NBA, the men's basketball.
And that's the question, because there are very few pro women's sports that get the type of attention. Because if you look at in the U.S., you know, Women's World Cup is huge when the U.S. women play in the World Cup, but the U.S. Women's Soccer League is not huge.
Yeah.
If you look at gymnastics, right, women's gymnastics in the Olympics, you know, is probably one of the most popular things of any Olympics, men or women, but it doesn't translate outside the Olympics. They're one-offs. And so the question is, can this translate into making women's basketball a global thing, not just a U.S. thing, but a global thing? And there was, you know, going back to when we were Max's age, you know, Glenn, when you and I were Max's age, you know, it was Larry Bird and Magic Johnson played in the NCAA finals.
Right.
And that translated into the NBA. And Bird and Magic became a thing that raised up the
really
the
elevated
NBA.
The whole NBA.
Elevated the NBA. Without Bird and Magic, I don't know if the NBA would be the global sport that it is today. Mm. Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark might be able to do that. I mean, you know, again, a white person, a white woman and a black woman. You have somebody who's more flashy, Angel Reese like Magic Johnson. You have somebody who's considered more workmanlike, you know, Caitlin Clark like Larry Bird. You know, one who's a great passer, one who's, you know, more ostentatious. But both of them winners, both of them fierce competitors, both of them.
Amazingly talented.
Amazingly talented and respected by everybody.
Yeah.
So you could see it's a lot to put on two people to say you're going to be the next Bird and Magic. But maybe this raises up women's sports professionally, and maybe this has a global impact. Basketball here, I don't know if basketball here in Singapore would be as popular without what Bird and Magic did and followed up with, you know, obviously, you know, Michael and Kobe and then LeBron and Steph. This could be that, and it could be that big. And so we really, you know, do hope that this will change things. And
fantastic.
You know, I was just going to say, I was on the, where it's not just, you know, the dads and with daughters watching. I was on a Zoom, which I often, you know, I do every once in a while with Mike McCurry, Thurgood Marshall Jr. and Peter Gold. So these are three guys who are, let's say, charitably 60s and up. And we were on a Zoom and they're all like, oh, wait, we got to go. Caitlin Clark is on. You would not have had three, you know, men in their 60s going, I got to go watch women's college basketball. But she has changed everything.
Right? Yeah.
Everything. Women, the sports to the NCAA Final Four, women's tickets are 47% more expensive than men's tickets.
Wow.
It is great to see, and I'm hopefully going to be able to watch the second half of Connecticut and Iowa. Mm-hmm. Which will have set records. And if it's Iowa, South Carolina, it will set more records.
Awesome. Steve, we do have to go. Thank you so much for filling in today for this hour for Neil. Great to have you on. We're going to see you next weekend. We got lots more to talk about next weekend when you come back.
Will Neil be back next week?
Neil will be back. I'm guaranteeing it. Have a great weekend.
You too.
All right.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at audio.sg or download the audio app. That's AWEDIO, audio at the App Store and Google Play.